welcome to the Wander Well Living Podcast, where we explore the highs and lows of life and the intricate spaces in between. I'm your host, Shaka Smith, and in that vein, we talk to inspiring individuals about their path through life's complexities. And today, we're joined by an amazing guest, award-winning civil rights attorney, CNN commentator, and founder of the Special Needs Network, Areva Martin. Welcome to the show. So excited to finally sit down with you. Got your mic.
It's been a journey, but we made it.
Yeah, we made it. Yeah, so we met a while ago. We met in an award show, and then you invited me to the Special Needs Network event 2 years in a row now. And I have to tell you, I didn't realize, such an amazing event, by the way. I didn't realize it was a personal story. I thought you were just an attorney who just kind of, you know, decided to do something. And for me, a lot of people don't know, but I have a chronic disease. And so I had a mom who, you know, she had to kind of take it upon herself. So I just commend you for doing that.
Thank you.
For people that have children that have to become overnight medical experts. And so I want to know, how did that journey of getting that diagnosis take you to founding the Special Needs Network?
Well, when I got my son's diagnosis, first of all, it took a minute to get to the right diagnosis, and that is not unusual. Lots of families who have kids who have developmental disabilities often struggle to get a diagnosis because either they don't have developmental pediatricians in their community, they don't even know that there are people who are developmental pediatricians, and oftentimes you don't have a child may not have all of the classic signs, so you get a lot of misinformation, and for many months, I was told that my son just had a speech impediment, and I was referred to a speech therapist. So we were going to speech therapy regularly, and I knew it was something more, so I had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing until my pediatrician finally referred us to a specialist. And so getting that diagnosis for him was just, in many ways, devastating, just to be honest with you. I didn't know at the time that I was experiencing a great deal of anguish, and I'll even say depression. I'm a lawyer. I'm used to, you know, questions, answers, problems, solutions. And this was one of those things where there weren't a lot of answers. There were more questions than answers. And as far as I could see, in the beginning of my journey, there didn't appear to be a lot of solutions. And so it was overwhelming for me. And it took probably about 6 months before I was able to stand up and kind of do what I do so easily for other people, but having to do it for my own son was a really different experience.
Yeah, and so you get the diagnosis, you're pushing for all of this, and at some point you decide, I have to do this for other people and let them get help too. How?
Yeah, I was taking a course over in South LA, and I'm self-employed. I set my own schedule. I can, you know, go this before COVID, where we all went into offices. I could go into an office when I chose to, leave when I chose to. And I was driving about an hour to South LA from my office that was in the Wilshire District. And there were these parents there. And for me, I was just there because I could. These families, though, had quit their jobs because their jobs didn't allow them to go to a 6-hour class twice a week. And that really resonated with me. That struck me like, wow, you know, I'm just coming because I have the ability to come, but these people have so much on the line.
Yeah.
They literally have quit their jobs, and they started looking to me because they found out I was an attorney for answers. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't there as an attorney. I was just there as a mom trying to get information for my son in the same way that they were. But I was compelled. I felt compelled when I would leave class to go home. I started studying. I didn't know a whole lot about the federal laws, the state laws that govern the benefits and services that you are entitled to when you have a special needs child. So I knew that I could learn that information. So I, you know, just kind of made myself an expert overnight in special education law and disability rights law. And I went back and would give information, would share information that I was learning. And then it just kind of struck me like, wow, if it's this group of parents, how many more people are in a similar situation? And another mom and I, we decided to kind of put our hypothesis to the test. And we rented the Boys and Girls Club on Vermont. And we said, we're just going to have an open forum, an open mic. We put a mic in the middle of the room. We invited some friends of ours who worked in the state legislature, some friends who worked in the LA Unified School District. And we put out a bunch of flyers. And so we're going to see how many families that look like us And to show up and hear what their stories are. And I tell you, 1,000, and I am not exaggerating, over the course of that day from about 9 until almost like 7 o'clock that night, over 1,000 families poured into that Boys and Girls Club and one by one came up to the mic and just told some of the most horrific stories you can imagine about their journey, their experiences, being discriminated against, being harassed, being put out of apartments, being evicted. I mean, just every horrible story you can think of, we heard that day. And that crystallized for me that there was work to be done.
Wow. And so you did all this work and you worked really hard and over 30,000 families, right?
Oh, we've been at the organization now is 15 years old, a little over 15 years. We've served, probably over 100,000 families.
Wow. And so you get to that point, but then you say, wait, I want to do more. And you decide to open a center. You're on TV, you're doing civil rights advocacy, you're doing your disability advocacy very successfully, but you want to do more. How did you arrive at that decision? And how is this sort of like, how is this the fruition of what you wanted to do at the beginning, at the outset?
Everything that, when I started the organization, it was always my intention to make it parent-focused. Like, what do parents want? What do they need? And I always try to think about what I needed in that moment for my son. And one of the things that I needed most was more time, access to more providers that were closer to me in space and time. And I realized that I, again, being self-employed, I used to take my son all the way to Santa Barbara once a week. We would get up at 5 in the morning, get on the road, drive to Santa Barbara, to UC Santa Barbara to meet with this specialist, spend the day there till 3 o'clock, get back on the road from Santa Barbara once a week. I mean, for about at least 5 months, religiously. And I just thought about all the traveling that I did with my son and how difficult and expensive that was. So the center was about how do we create the Santa Barbaras of the world, but in the proximity, in the neighborhood where people don't typically have access. So when my son was much younger, most of the services that you didn't have to go to Santa Barbara per se, but that's where the specialist was. But most of the services were in the West Valley. They were up and down Ventura Boulevard, starting in the West Valley. So again, if you live in South LA, getting to the West Valley is no easy feat. So I looked around in kind of the LA proper community and didn't see the same level of services, the same kinds of facilities that I knew existed in other places in the county. So the center was about bringing the best into a neighborhood that had been overlooked and was often forgotten.
Wow, and congratulations on the opening.
Thank you. Huge, absolutely huge. Thank you.
And you got the city to commit a lot of money to the opening as well.
It's a collaboration with the county of Los Angeles. It is a almost $50 million project, a three-story building that things just kind of fall into place. Jacqueline Avant, who was the wife of Clarence Avant, record mogul, the movie Godfather by Reggie Hudlin on Netflix, the documentary. Jacqueline was a big supporter of kids in the Watts-Willowbrook community. And so when she was tragically murdered, her family was looking for ways to honor her legacy. And so there was an effort put forth to name this building the Jacqueline Avant Child and Family Center. And so her daughter, who's Nicole Avant, who's a former ambassador under President Obama, who's married to, the CEO of Netflix, it was just beautiful to be able to honor Jacqueline and her legacy by naming the building after her. So our center now sits in the Jacqueline Avant Child and Family Center because Jacqueline dedicated so much of her life and her philanthropy to children in Watts-Willowbrook. So the county, built the building. We've had countless numbers of private foundations and philanthropists who donated money and resources so that we could have this state-of-the-art center right in Watts Willowbrook.
Yeah, and I think that's what you've done so well is collaborate well and build community around what you've done, even people that aren't part of the community. What were your strategies for building community, and how might someone else employ that to around their advocacy?
It's a lot of hard work. Start with there. Relationships, you know, there's no substitute for building relationships and sharing your dream and finding commonality with other people. Like, I knew Clarence Avant because, you know, he's a legend in this town. And in my early career as a lawyer, I did some entertainment law, so that's how I got introduced to him. But I didn't know about the work that his wife did. I didn't know, you know, Nicole, the daughter, was so, again, intimately involved in preserving her mother's legacy. So just building relationships, and it just kind of sounds cliche-ish, but I really take to heart the, I don't meet strangers, and I try to be nice to everybody.
Yeah.
Because you don't know, you know, there's a, I don't know, attitude, I think, sometimes in a town like LA, where people try to rate you on who they think you are or what they think you have going on or what you drive. And I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in St. Louis. So I was, I just kind of dance to a different beat. And I try to remember a lot of what, you know, I say Midwesterners, what's kind of makes us kind of the tough individualist that we are, but people who are pretty grounded and rooted. And I think that's been a lot of how, that's how I build relationships, is I've been very privileged. I've had a lot of opportunities, but I don't think I am any better than anyone else. And I'm a serial entrepreneur, and I've done every job there is to do in my business. And I do mean every job. I will mop a floor. I will, you know, stay up all night and file documents and legal files. So I don't think that I, you know, have, that I'm so important. I'll put it like that. I have a lot of confidence, so I'm not, you know, unaware of my success. But I think when you treat people with respect and you recognize their humanity and their dignity, you know, you treat them in a dignified way, that goes a long way.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that reflected in your civil rights advocacy as well. And I want to ask you a little bit about that. What do you see currently in this crazy state of the world that we live in today as some of the systemic barriers to civil rights that are most pressing today, and how do we sort of tackle them yourself and then together collectively?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that we are much further along or advanced than we really are. And a lot of people think, whether it's women's issues or issues that minorities face, that didn't we solve that? Like, you know, didn't we already have that movement? You know, like, really? That's an issue? So I think that's one of the biggest issues, is people, you know, believing the headlines and not recognizing that, although, yes, there's been tremendous progress made on issues of civil rights, you know, since, you know, the time of pioneers like Dr. Martin Luther King, that there's also been a lot of setbacks. There's been a lot of things that today that make it very difficult to advance civil rights, things like having a very conservative Supreme Court. We see the dismantling of abortion rights. We see the dismantling of affirmative action and college admissions. Those are things that, you know, in many ways set the civil rights movement back decades.
Yeah. And so in your civil rights advocacy, what is it we can do to maybe on those issues that are close to our hearts to move the needle?
Yeah, I think it's education, and awareness. I think, again, if someone has in their mind, because they work in a workplace with women, that women now somehow have parity in the workplace with men, or that we have closed the wage gap between men and women, it's our, you know, we have a duty, an obligation to educate them about the fallacy of their belief in that regard. So, you know, I'm constantly helping people understand that, yes, we can celebrate. Two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
We can acknowledge progress and acknowledge the need to make more progress.
Yeah. And I love that. And you use that reflected in your presence on social media. How do you view that presence, and I guess what's the responsibility as a public figure to influence public policy?
Yeah. So, you know, social media is both a blessing and a curse, right? Yeah. We love it at times and we hate it at times. And I think, like most folks, you know, I've gone through iterations in terms of my social. If you look back, you know, early days, you may see one, image and message reflected. And then over time, obviously it changes. Now what I try to do again is use my social media to educate people about those issues that, you know, I'm a news junkie. I read 2,500 newspapers or something every day. Not everybody does that. Not everybody's tuned in to the news like that. So I try to use my social to bring awareness about those big issues that I think people should know about. Like, you don't have to read like the paper all day, have alerts on your phone, you know, pinging you all day like I do. But there are things that I think most people, you know, kind of want to know what's happening. So I try to use my social as a place where people can come and get reliable, trusted information.
Yeah. And I know for myself, when you just said, you know, you get the pings all day and the 25,000, I got a little anxiety. I know for myself, I like to keep my phone on silent because I get a little anxiety when I get too much information at me.
Yeah.
How have you balanced, you know, wearing all these hats? What's your self-care routine? Are you doing yoga? Are you writing in a journal? What do you do?
Great question. So when you love what you do, it doesn't feel like work. So because I love news, it's not work. When I'm reading all these papers, it's like I have this voracious appetite for information. So it doesn't feel like work, but I do. I'm very in tune with self-care. I work out. I was a runner for many, many years. I ran several half marathons. I haven't run a full marathon, but I've run several halves, a lot of 10Ks, a lot of 5Ks. And I had an injury a couple of years ago, so I haven't been running as much, but I go to the gym regularly. I love reading novels. Right now, I am obsessed with Beverly Jenkins. She writes Black historical romance novels.
Oh.
Yes, and I met her during COVID on a streaming show that I did called The Special Report. And everybody was home during COVID, so I don't even know how I found her. I just got turned on to her, and I bought a couple of her books. And she's written over 40 books, and I probably have read like 38 of them. So I do that. I watch mindless TV. I watch the same things over and over and over, because that way, you know, I don't have to put a whole lot of energy into like following the plot. And if I miss something, it's okay, because I've already seen it like 10 times, right? So that's one way that I relax as well. I travel a lot. I just got back from Chicago, headed to New York tonight. That's why I sent you that email. I'll go back to DC next week. So I like traveling, because on the plane, again, I get to like read my Beverly Jenkins novel. I get to catch up on movies that I haven't seen. So there are times when I just like cut everything off, including the pings on the phone, and just got to veg out.
Yeah. Was that hard for you, setting boundaries for yourself to make sure? Or is this something that you've always been very kind of intuitive about?
I don't think it was hard. I think I am very in tune with the fact that I give a lot, and it's okay when I'm not available and I don't respond, you know, immediately to people. So no, I don't struggle with that. I'm I'm off today, not doing that. I'll get back to it. So I know a lot of women do, in particular women, because, you know, oftentimes, particularly in families, there's so many high expectations about women as caregivers, as nurturers. And I know, because I talk to these women, a lot of women struggle with it. It hasn't been particularly one of my struggles. I'd say I have a different struggle. Mine is like, you know, like slow my brain down, like, you know, a new idea a minute. I call myself a serial entrepreneur because I'm always thinking of like new stuff to start. So that's probably my struggle.
And how has your advocacy evolved over time? And were there any kind of moments that shifted and shaped that? And I guess with your self-care, if that had to shift and shape, be shifted and shaped with that as well.
Yeah, I think my advocacy has evolved over time. Really, in the early days of my civil rights practice, I did a lot more like single plane of work, where I would represent an individual. So a woman in a sexual harassment case, or a person in a discrimination case, or maybe a police brutality case. More recently, I've been doing a lot more what we call like impact litigation, where there are lots of people involved and the outcome of the case can have far-reaching implications for other cases. And so I really enjoy that. I really like that, because it's like, and that's why I gravitated to TV in my career, because, you know, I could help one person, represent one person, but being a legal analyst on TV and helping people understand the law and advocating, you know, gave me an opportunity to, you know, reach so many more people, you know, than I could ever reach in terms of just individual representation.
Yeah, and that career, not everyone's built for that. But some people can kind of work into the qualities. What are the qualities that you think are necessary to be an emerging leader in that space?
Well, I think you've got to figure out who you are.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and we can substitute the word leader for brand or, you know, whatever you kind of think about yourself as. But, you know, there's a lot of pressure for people to, you know, try to live up to standards that have been set by other people. And I think one of the truest forms of leadership is someone knowing, you know, who they are and what they stand for. You know, what principles are important to them and how do they live up to those principles? Recognizing that in this world, sometimes we all have to make compromises. You know, we can't get everything we want out of every situation, but I think the leaders that we most respect are those leaders who have been consistent. Now, and sometimes it's not always a position that we agree on, but they've been consistent in terms of how they present themselves to the world.
Yeah, well, consistency is definitely important over time. When you talk to someone who's young in social advocacy or civil rights, whether it's a young attorney or someone on social media who wants to continue to build their community, what is sort of your seminal advice for someone who does want to wander well and have a career that's a long career?
You know, I tell them to find something they're passionate about and go deep. Mm-hmm. Because again, there's so many pulls on people, I think, and the tendency is, you know, I want to, you know, be a gardener, I want to be an interior decorator, I want to be a comedian, I want to be an actor, I want to be a model, you know, and like, and you may be skilled in all of those areas, but if you want to be like an expert, you got to have a, you know, a depth and a breadth of knowledge, because if people are going to come to you for advice, they want to know that, you know, it's more than just surface. Like, you've done this more than, like, you know, today, right? Like, you've been doing this for a while. So I just tell people, you know, find one thing, go deep into that. That doesn't mean you have to stay there forever. You can always branch out and do other things, but that was some advice someone gave me. I paid a lot of money to get that advice too. I remember going down to San Diego, it's like life coach person. And it was all kind of like common sense stuff, but not, yeah. You know, sometimes we miss even the basics. And that was some of the best advice someone gave me about, like, you know, find something you are really passionate about and just go deep in it and become known for that. Mm-hmm. And then you get to add all the other layers, because we all are multi-layered and, you know, nuanced, so we're not all, you know, just black and white. So that would be my advice for someone.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like in this world we can do so many different things, so why not do all the things that we want to do?
Absolutely. I am a firm believer in that. There's a professor that had a big influence on my civil rights practice. His name is Charles Ogletree. He just passed away.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful book I read.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's just amazing. I had an opportunity to study under him at Harvard. And they had his memorial back in Boston recently. He died a couple months ago. And I was listening to the memorial. And the thing that struck me the most, because about him that I didn't know, like, he had so many things that he had influenced. Like, he went to South Africa after the you know, fall of apartheid. And he was involved in helping them create their new, you know, legal system and the new governing system. He worked directly with Nelson Mandela. He had been a criminal defense attorney in Boston and had tried capital murder cases and had successfully, you know, represented people who were on death row. He had become a really big advocate around the death penalty and other kind of laws that impacted criminal defendants. I mean, he had just done so much. He went down, he bought a house in Martha's Vineyard, and he started in the summer holding these workshops and, well, I don't even call it a workshop, because he hosted Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, it was like this list of things, and every one of the people that spoke at the funeral would get up and just say how they connected to him. And I was like, wow. I mean, and he got early onset Alzheimer's. So at the time that he got really sick, he was probably like mid-50s. So you think about a life, typically graduate. He graduated from Stanford. Maybe he's 20. So I don't know. But you think about someone in a 25 to 30 year span, because by then, by the time he's mid-50s, he was very sick. He had done so much. I was like in awe. So you're right. There are, you know, this life presents so many opportunities. And what I loved about his story too, you know, they just talked about, even though he had literally you know, presidents and vice presidents in his living room on a regular. He was just an everyday guy. And his wife said that when he was defending these defendants in Boston, he would, like, if you were getting out of jail and he had represented you and you didn't have anywhere to go, they would end up at their house. Wow. Where literally he was housing them and helping them get jobs. And, you know, he treated that criminal defendant in the same way that he would treat a president of the United States. So it was just, he was just a remarkable man.
That kind of leads me to my next question is, with your work in this space in civil rights and disability advocacy, what do you hope your legacy will be?
You know, I hope that the work that I'm doing is sustained, particularly when you are what's considered a charismatic founder of a nonprofit. Many nonprofits, after the founder leaves, they tank.
Yeah.
They just implode for various reasons. And I got very concerned about that about 8-9 years into the nonprofit. And the biggest reason is because typically the person that starts it, they have the passion, right? They'll have the relationship so they can raise the money and people are relating to that individual. And many of the founders, there's a whole syndrome, they have it, they call it, don't build a strong infrastructure or a way for that organization to sustain itself beyond them. Like when people aren't giving money because they're my friends or they have some relationship to me, how do you make sure that they're gonna, you know, be supportive of this organization because of the work that it does, not because of our personal relationship? So I started working, that really made me nervous because I was like, I would hate to do all of this. And then when I decide to do whatever else, you know, it closes, and I've seen that. I've literally seen that happen. So I just hope that my legacy is that I built a strong organization and that I brought other people along and that I continue to lift as I climbed. That's really important to me, that I, you know, create other leaders. And I'm not like, I know a whole lot, but I know what I don't know. And I'm not one of these leaders that's afraid to have other smart people around me. Like, no, I need really smart people around me. So I hope that's my legacy.
Well, I definitely think a $50 million center helps. And of course, all the families that you've helped certainly helps with that. I want to know, you know, we're in almost, it's an election year coming up.
Scary.
You know, so really civil rights and disability advocacy is, you know, on the table. What do you see in that realm in the next 10 years?
It's going to be interesting. You know, I don't know how political you want to get in this conversation, but you know, there is a pathway where we could, you know, not recognize our democracy in the next 10 years. And then I think there's a pathway where we will see more women of color, more people of color in, you know, leadership positions in ways that we've never seen in this country.
Yeah. And you have a podcast where you do talk a lot about politics.
Yeah.
How do you balance that in this sort of very volatile time? It feels like it's a very volatile time.
Yeah, I gauge when, you know, I should be having certain conversations with certain people. And, you know, I'm mature enough to know I don't have to have an opinion about everything. Mm-hmm. I don't have to always state my opinion about everything in every conversation. So I think you just have to be discerning. And I think people have to use their, you know, their emotional intelligence. Like, I'm not going to a dinner party getting in a fight with you about your politics. I'm just not. Like, there's no reason to.
Time, place, and manner.
You know, let's have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Chill out. So I think that the folks that are having the most difficult time are those people that feel like every conversation that they have and everyone that they meet, you know, they've got to engage them. And then, you know, they feel like they've got to convince them. Like,
yeah.
I'm also, you know, sufficiently clear that it is not my job to convert you to believe in what I believe in. It's okay that you have your beliefs and I have mine, and we can hopefully find some common ground. So that's how I'm not having senseless arguments with people.
Yeah, I think that's very important, especially now in this time that we're in. But hopefully we can progress as a society. What advice do you have for us when we talk about these conversations, like time, place, and manner? How do we internalize some of that and have productive conversations around some of these issues that we want to build community around?
I think, you know, a big part of it is understanding the time and the place for certain conversations. I just interviewed two psychologists, and we were talking about navigating complex relationships, particularly during the holidays, and they gave some great advice. And, like, you know, the simple thing, like, you want to critique someone's attire, right? And that could lead to a really big argument, could lead to you falling out with a friend. And one of the pieces of advice they gave, which I thought was really a good piece of advice I'm going to use, is asking you for, like, one first piece of advice is, if you have to say something negative to someone, sandwich it in between a whole lot of positive. And ask if that person wants to have that feedback or that conversation. So, wow, your style is amazing. Like, you kill it. Every time I see you, you're fabulous. But we're going to go out, like, tomorrow, and, you know, we both are going to be dressed, blah, blah, blah. How would you feel if we talk about each other's outfits? Do you want to do that? And the person might say, nah, I'm good. Then you know, whatever you think about it, good, bad, or don't touch it, right? But if they say, yeah, let's do that, now you've been given permission, right, to weigh in on it. And even then, you've got to do it in a way that the person can hear you and not, you know, in a horribly mean-spirited way. So, you know, I just think respecting people, and again, not feeling like you have to always be right. And just because you want to talk about something doesn't mean I want to talk about it at that time. Like, maybe you want to ask me, hey, Reeve, you feel like talking about politics? I may say, oh, not today. I, like, you know, I'm, you know, on overload with politics. No, let's talk about something else. So I think a part of it is getting, again, out of ourselves. And, you know, we are in a vanity culture, so it's kind of hard sometimes for us to recognize that other people are on the planet other than us, and they have feelings, and we need to take them into consideration.
Yeah, some good practical advice for turbulent times.
Yes.
Well, I do like to have a little Q&A if anyone has any questions for Ms. Martin. Oh, we have one in the back.
Autism.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's on the autism spectrum. Yes, autism spectrum disorder. Yeah.
How, and he's doing well now?
My son's doing great. We've been very blessed as a family. We have lots of services for him as a kid, and yeah, he's doing well.
Amazing.
Very blessed.
Any more questions?
So I've been to quite a few of your events.
Oh, thank you.
Who comes up with the ideas for these events? Is it you or the team? Because they're incredible.
Well, first of all, thank you for that. Definitely a team effort. I do have one of the vice president of my board happens to be a friend from law school, happens to be my entertainment attorney. So she works in entertainment, and she has a son that's also on the spectrum. And she saw me give an interview on television or something about my son. And it's at the same time she was going through getting her son diagnosed. And she called me. We hadn't seen each other in a while. And she said, I want to come to your office and get some information. And she came, and I gave her some information. She says, what do I owe you? I said, well, you don't owe me any money, but I do need you to come onto the board of this nonprofit and to help lead some of our events, because you work in the business. She has lots of contacts, lots of friends. So she has been amazing in terms of bringing her relationships and just her creativity from working, and she's a writer too. So that has been a part of what you have seen is a manifestation of she and I and some others working together.
So. Nice.
Congratulations on marketing.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Another question?
How can Shaka's friends and fans support you and your initiatives?
Wow, that's a great question. Thank you. You can go to if you want to support the nonprofit, it's Special Needs Network, and our website is snnla.org, and you can sign up. We have a big Christmas giveaway that we're doing on December 17th, where we're going to give away over 5,000 toys to kids in Leimert Park. That's on Sunday, December 17th, and then on that Saturday, December 16th, we're actually hosting a party in our center for kids on the spectrum with their siblings. So on our website, there are opportunities to volunteer, there are opportunities to donate. We'd love for you to follow us on social media, all of our social media sites, but there are always opportunities for folks who want to give back, want to, like I said, volunteer. We love volunteers. We love for people to come and see our work. And I'm really, like I saw a couple of my sponsors at an event on Sunday. I'm, again, my Midwestern show me state kind of attitude, you know, give money to my nonprofits is a good thing, but I always tell people as a lawyer, you know, check them out, go to GuideStar, make sure they're legit, because unfortunately some folks aren't always, but I like folks to come and touch and feel and see the work that we do. I think it's important. I take very seriously being a steward of the money that people give us and using it effectively and efficiently and people seeing their money in action. And that's how we've been able to grow from like a volunteer in my law firm to over 300 employees and, you know, a massive budget. And it's always my belief, like, you're much more inclined to want to give money to folks when you can see it, which is why they have all those little sad commercials with the kids. You know, they want you to sign up. Like, you know, it's all programmed, the music and the poor looking little kids. So that's what you can definitely go and check out the work that we're doing. And with our center now, you literally can come and see. We have a state-of-the-art music center, tech center. We created this living life skills center. Because one of the things that happen when kids get older who have disabilities is most of them live at home. And they live at, well, if they're fortunate enough to have families where they can live at home, it's because they don't have jobs or sometimes they don't have the life skills to live independently. So we created in our center, literally you walk into a center, it's like a kitchen with a washer and dryer, it's a bed, it's a dresser, all the things that you kind of take for granted as you grow up, kind of neurotypical. But if you are a kid who's not neurotypical, even something as simple as learning to make up your bed, do your laundry, things that are important to living independently often don't get taught. So we wanted to, when I thought about, again, as a parent, like, what are all the things I know my son struggled with, and I know other parents, you know, are probably having the same issue. So we thought about from like a 2-year-old that gets a diagnosis to a 22-year-old who wants to now go live independently. So, and we'd love to have Shaka and his friends come and visit our center.
Yes, please tap in. Another question.
What would the volunteer be doing? What would that look like?
So at the big event on December 17th, everything from doing arts and crafts with kids, helping to serve food, we give away food, helping to give away the presents, wrapping presents. One of our partners has this idea that we're literally going to wrap 6,000 plus toys. And we're trying to convince them that that's a heavy lift, but you know, the point is a lot of kids maybe have never had a wrapped toy. Mm. And this might be their only toy gift that goes under their tree if they have a tree. So starting 4 days before this event, there's gift wrapping opportunities. And then at the event itself, sometimes people just greeting kids, greeting families, serving food, giving out toys, helping at booths where we, you know, the kids will be making different Christmas related items.
All hands on deck.
All hands on, yes, absolutely.
And of course, in the civil rights area, how can people contact you or tap in on that side? I know you're off to your podcast soon, so.
Yes, yeah, so no, my personal, you can follow me on my personal social pages at Areva Martin and my website, arevamartin.com. And a lot of the work that I'm doing in the civil rights space right now is happening in Palm Springs. I'm representing over 1,000 survivors and descendants who were bulldozed and burned out of their homes in Palm Springs in the 1950s and 60s. So I've been working in that area for about a year now, and we've been doing activations in Palm Springs. We've been holding rallies. We just had a big justice rally in October. In January around MLK Day, in February around Black History Month, we'll be doing some activations. So a lot of that work is also on my website. So.
And they did. There was a beach that was returned recently to a family.
Bruce's Beach happened. That was a Manhattan Beach property that had been illegally taken from Charles and Willa Bruce, who owned four parcels of land in Manhattan Beach. They had like a boarding house. It was one of the few homes back in the early 20s and 30s where African Americans who came to Manhattan Beach could stay. And there was an effort to return that property back to the descendants of Charles and Willa Bruce. It was a successful action. The county, the state, and you know, lots of other players got involved. And eventually the property was leased to the county and then sold. And the proceeds went to the descendants of Charles and Willa Bruce.
Multiple million. So at least there's a precedent for this.
And I just left. I said I was in Chicago. I was actually at the reason I was there was at a reparations conference. And around the country, really, cities like Detroit and St. Louis and New Orleans, California, we just went through a 2-year reparations process where reparations committee met around the state and issued a 1,000-page report with about 100 recommendations about how California can repair the harm that was done to African American descendants of slaves. So there's a whole movement taking place around the country, whether it's with cities or states and even private institutions like Georgetown University. There's been lots of acknowledgement by colleges like Georgetown that their campuses and their colleges were started because of slave owners or money that was gained because of the trading or selling of slaves. And so Georgetown, in one of its efforts, they've set aside over $300 million scholarships right now for descendants of slaves descendants of those slaves that are responsible for Georgetown.
Well, speaking for myself, we're so appreciative of your efforts and your energy on the front lines to be doing this work for so many years. Just thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and you keep coming back.
We'd
love to have you. Love your volunteerism. Love your support, because that's how nonprofits grow. They need money, they need structure and good management, but they need lots of volunteers. So
absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for joining us here at the Wonder Well Living podcast. You guys can find us at Wonder Well Living on all platforms. And thank you guys for being here. Have a good day.